So, people have been saying hot labor summer. Hopefully, it is hot labor year, hot labor decade, hot labor century. But United Auto Workers are on strike. We've had these waves of labor actions. It's been incredibly exciting. But I wanted to highlight that because here in Atlanta, we've got a plant, a Stellantis plant, and we've got the workers striking. And I love to see it because we had our governor of the state tell the auto companies, you'll see no union trouble in Georgia. And I love that he's seeing that union trouble in Georgia. Been out there on the picket line a few times myself. The energy is high, but just wanted to let y'all know that these people are putting in the work. It is a weird, difficult industry. The United Auto Workers have gone through so much through the years of union infiltration and being, repressed and bad contracts. And these guys are struggling with a lot, but we're seeing that. We're super excited. So I really wanted to like open up the episode to say like we're talking about this stuff. We're talking about this bogus book, Compassionate Capitalism, today, and we'll get into it as well as 10 Powerful Phrases. And it talks all about the ways that we can have compassion and solidarity. But I wanted to like open up right at the stop. The way we have compassion, the way we have solidarity, the way we help each other is just through this kind of thing. You have the writers now, the Writers Guild. They're actually getting to go back to work because they're potentially coming to a deal. You see, and apparently Ford is already starting to crack on the United Auto Workers. That's what I'm hearing through the grapevine. So that's what we're pushing for. Go out to the picket line if you can, support if you can. Usually posting isn't praxis, but putting out a post can actually be helpful because we're putting pressure on the companies. They need to feel like they don't have public support. So yeah, absolutely.
What
So
about
let's get into it.
reading books by Richard DeVos? Is that praxis?
Yes. So welcome once again to the Socialist Shelf. There are more things on the shelves than prose novels, indeed. And today we're picking out the first one, the first two, Compassionate Capitalism and 10 Powerful Phrases for Positive People, both by Richard DeVos. Now, I will say the praxis, Josh, in reading these is, I suppose, a form of inoculation. Like you read these and then you realize, oh, this capitalism thing is actually kind of bogus. We ought to organize against that. Because who, boy, does Rich really indict the whole system in certain places without himself meaning to?
Yeah, no, this is the interesting thing about this book, these books, is that he seems to be on some level aware of what the problems are, or at least he starts to become aware of them, but then he can't go the next steps to actually get to diagnose the core of those problems because it would go against his class positioning. And so he creates this bizarre fantasy world in which, the big problem with everything is that we're just not nice enough. And if we could just be nicer and also be capitalists, oh boy, we would have a great time.
Well, y'all might
Oh,
be noticing a third voice on the podcast. I should have done this at the beginning, but this is Josh Borman, a returning guest
hello.
from Worst of All Possible Worlds. I know y'all liked the American War episode. He is back. And we are really excited to talk about these books, even though I wasn't like hyped to read them necessarily. But it's going to be an interesting conversation. And Josh, you actually recommended these books. You have a history sort of with the whole DeVos thing, which I think more people actually have a history with the DeVos thing than they know because he's had such
Yeah.
a impact on culture. But do you want to give them a brief rundown and we can go more into it later of what makes you interested in this, what your history with it is, and why are these books worth examining and talking about outside of just like sheer like, haha, this is ridiculous, which there is that value as well.
Yeah, well, I grew up in the fair town of Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Joss, you recently visited our fair town.
The rapids aren't all that grand, but
No.
the river's pretty. The
Yeah, the river's
skyline
great.
is, is there.
They're looking to, because basically what they did was they dammed up the rapids, and so now the river just runs through downtown. Apparently, one of the things that they are looking to do at some point is actually restore some of the natural rapids,
Okay.
because one of the consequences of the damming is that downtown floods a lot. And so if they can maybe restore the way that the river more naturally works, that might happen less frequently. But of course, this is more about Rich DeVos himself, the author of these books. He is the co-founder of Amway, which of course is short for the American Way Corporation, the sort of OG pyramid scheme company.
Yeah.
And so this book and these books are really just sort of exploring his vision for what the best possible world could look like. But if you ask me, it's more like the worst of all possible worlds.
So true.
Hey.
Somebody's making a podcast about that.
I know, right?
And Amway sells, I mean, just stuff. Neutralite, yeah. You know, like
soap.
Health and beauty products, soap. Just like, kind of like, it's just products. It's not, there's nothing. And as you'll see, he speaks in very grandiose terms about what he sells. And like, if you look up the list of products, I mean, like, it's just, it's not particularly remarkable. But yeah, Josh, what's like, Rich's, you, I think you said that he spoke at your school. Am I correct?
He did. Yeah. So, I went to Grand Rapids Christian High School, which he actually name checks at the end of, 10 powerful phrases.
Yeah.
So that auditorium that he mentions, I sat in that because we were all, after that auditorium was finished, there was this big assembly that everybody had to go to where they basically just sat Rich DeVos on stage and sucked him off for an hour. And then at the end, we all got a copy of his fucking book.
Which book was it?
That book. The
10 Powerful Phrases?
10 Powerful Phrases.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's one of those things where the DeVos family, along with the Van Andel family, which was, you know, Rich's partner in creating Amway,
yeah.
Those two families had such an instrumental role in the development of the city of Grand Rapids
yes.
from the 1950s onward. And
you know about it.
Oh,
he powerful phrases.
And as Josh can no doubt attest, I mean, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting at least two things that are labeled with either the DeVos or Van Andel names.
Oh, dude, let me tell you, like I was in Grand Rapids a couple of weekends ago for a wedding. Right. And, you know, my partner and I were walking down Pearl Street to go to the public museum, Van Andel money.
Good museum.
And it is a good museum. You know, $12 for three levels of little bit of everything, you know.
Yeah.
I recommend it. But I saw off to the side before we crossed the river, this planter with a plaque like, oh, you know, dedicated to the civic, you know, municipal service of Richard DeVos. And I'm like, wait, DeVos, that DeVos?
Mm-hmm.
And then I turned around, and there, looming up behind me like a fucking monolith, is the Amway Grand.
Yep.
And speaking of DeVos, yeah. You might recognize the name Betsy DeVos, which would be, she is the wife of Richard DeVos, the child of, that's right, right? That's
a,
that's
DeVos. So yeah. Betsy is, Betsy got married to Rich's son, Dick.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the grand.
So Rich's daughter-in-law.
Yes, from the from the Prince family of
yep.
Blackwater fame.
Yeah, all these people get married like weird lords and have
it
their...
is it's like fucking, you know, Habsburg shit.
Exactly.
they keep it in the family.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes,
as somehow
Teddy Roosevelt
less
said,
cool,
you know?
The Habsburgs, but like with basically just selling cheap plastic. It's depressing.
If the Habsburgs were around today, but they are around today, they just they mostly do like Formula One racing, I think.
Well, I think that what's going to happen is that over time, the sort of DeVos family tree will just grow more and more inbred with the natural consequences, you know.
We have to. One has to hope. No, so yeah, Joss, you've got the bio of our main man here.
Oh boy, do I.
At
oh
least
boy,
the
do
oversome.
I.
And yeah, so why don't you bring us into this?
Yes, all right. So Richard DeVos, Richard Marvin DeVos Sr.
Marvin?
Marvin is his middle name, yes.
Come on!
Yeah, you don't get that from the book, that's for sure.
R.M.D.
Born 4th of March 1926 in the great and glorious city of Grand Rapids, Michigan. His parents are hardworking blue-collar Dutch Americans. They both work in the electrical field. I was reading a paper about What was it? Oh, yes. Amway as neoliberal religious tradition.
Yeah.
And from that, I learned that, you know, their background is very like, it's very like Dutch Calvinist in origin, right? Particularly based on the writings of this guy, Abraham Kuyper.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Who believes, essentially, from my understanding, rights don't derive from the individual. They don't derive from the state. He believes in something called sphere sovereignty. So basically, the affairs of the press are the press, the affairs of education are education, the affairs of the family are the family, or so on. And as you'll see, there's ideological continuity in what the DeVosses support and fund over the years. So,
and I mean, Calvin gets name-checked in yes. Compassion. Not even name, I say name-checked. He gets talked about. He gets basically said he sowed the seeds of capitalism, which is, I mean, actually a correct analysis.
And the other thing that definitely shouldn't be missed about Abraham Kuyper is that he was sort of also the core philosopher, you could say, who really paved the way for sort of the Afrikaner movement in South Africa, everything to do with apartheid. All of that rolls up to these ideas that Abraham Kuyper pioneered. Really great
yes.
guy.
Yes, and he believes that, you know, workers should be happy with their lot. You know, the afterlife will be more of a reward. Revolution is just unstable by nature, and, you know, yada, yada, yada.
Yep. All,
yeah. Precursor to a lot of rancid shit. So the Great Depression strikes when DeVos is very young, and during one of the most grotesque financial collapses capitalism has ever wrought, he gets interested, of course, in business. His grandfather at the time is selling produce out of a wagon door to door in the early 1930s, and he gives Rich a leftover bag of onions. And young Rich does the same.
As was the style at the time.
As was the style at the time, yeah. He earned just a few pennies. I earned just a few pennies, he says, but that memorable achievement was a definitive moment in who I became as a man, Rich wrote in his book, Simply Rich. It took salesmanship and persistence, but I love... He's really handy with a title as Rich DeVos. Okay, so he's not a good student in high school, but he cleans up his act. He ultimately graduates in 1944 as class president. It's during his high school years now that he starts his lifelong friendship with Jay Van Andel. And Jay is 2 years older, he's got a Model A Ford, and Rich pays him a quarter a week for rides to school. That's how their friendship starts.
Oh, I know that. You know how I know that? Because at Grand Rapids Christian High School, in the lobby of the auditorium, they have a replica of that car in there right outside the fucking theater, and it's festooned with this plaque telling that story.
That fucking... Oh, man.
You know what would be funny? Like, did they do that thing at your high school where, like, they park a crashed car out front to, like, turn you off of drunk driving?
No. No. We don't do that kind of thing in Michigan. We would never abuse an innocent car like that.
Oh, because I was about to say, like, we did that here, and how fucked would it be if they did that with a fucking, like, Model A?
Combine it. Tell the story, but it says, but then, tragedy struck.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Well,
two lessons in one. You've got one lesson about the Protestant work ethic, and then a second lesson about safe driving.
Right.
Well, he avoids a fair few tragedies in his time, as we'll see.
I will say he, at least according to him, he apparently helped pay his tuition to the Christian school after he started doing bad at grades, which I thought was interesting. It connects back to his dad and his family being pretty broke. But I thought it was notable, like from the young age, it's kind of we went uphill both ways
It's kind of hard to know how much of that is true and how much of it is just him embellishing, but it
yes.
is definitely clear that, like, his class positioning was lower than Jay Van Andel,
no
who
doubt.
Would end up being his business partner at Amway.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you have that element of, oh, you know, I have something to aspire to right off the bat.
Yeah.
Chip on his shoulder for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's the word I'm looking for. So he graduates in 1944. He joins the Army Air Corps toward the end of the Second World War, where he serves in the Pacific. He's a flight line mechanic on Tinian in the Northern Mariana Islands. I couldn't find specifics on his service, but I'm pretty sure he gets there after the Battle of Tinian in July through August. So he misses the real fireworks, but it goes on to be the busiest airfield of the Pacific War. Operation Meeting House, what's known in Japan as the Great Tokyo Air Raid, is carried out from there, as are the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So he's kind of adjacent to that.
He was an Oppenheimer. Sorry, go on.
Okay, so the war ends. Jay has saved $700 from his military pay. Now, the two have wanted to start a business together for years. So they start a flying school after the war, which fails. They start a drive-in restaurant that also fails. In 1948, their next big idea is, okay, we'll have a travel business, right? So they buy a boat and they go sailing from the East Coast down to the Caribbean and to South America to sort of, you know, have a working
vacation. That was the
goal. Yes, that was the goal. Yes. They get lost off of New Jersey in some marshes. They got to get towed by the Coast Guard back out to sea. They do make it to the Caribbean. In March 1949, they're going from Havana to Haiti. And the boat has sprung a leak by this time. They lose it in 1,500 foot water, 10 miles off the northern coast of Cuba, goes the story. So they barely left Cuba.
I sent Joss a thing, and it was like the Utopian, and it said, like, Society of Jay and Rich had drowned off the coast of Cuba.
Honestly, how funny, how ironic would that be?
If And what's crazy is, like, one of his close personal friends, Gerald Ford, like, also had a scare with, like, the ocean, right? Because Ford served in the Pacific War. He almost got washed overseas in overboard, rather, in a hurricane. It's weird how these things kind of rhyme. So they unbelievably, they get rescued by the cruiser Attabel Likes. It doesn't cut their trip short. They tour the Caribbean and South America for 5 more months, but that's it for the boat. So August 19th.
By then the boat was just fucking toast. It was done.
It's somewhere on the bottom. I'm sure Amway will fund an expedition there one day.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe with a submarine. We might get that.
That would be good. That's how rich. No,
do you know what's funny? So he cites as one of his heroes, one of the social entrepreneurs, as he calls them, Benjamin Rush in Compassionate Capitalism. Mm-hmm. I looked up Benjamin Rush. One of his descendants is a guy named Stockton Rush, which, for those listening, if you don't remember that name, Stockton Rush was the co-founder of OceanGate.
Oh my God.
And he took four other guys down. Yes, the descendant of Benjamin Rush is Stockton Rush, who went under the sea and became fucking marinara sauce with four other guys.
Oh my God. Like, it really is. So this is the wild thing, too, about, you asked me about, like, why I am so interested in this. People will talk about, like, conspiracy theories, right? Uh-huh. And point to, it's all connected. But with this shit, it actually is all connected. And we'll talk about examples of this, but, like, growing up in Grand Rapids, it was the thing where it's like, if you didn't respect the order of things and you didn't respect this sicko fucking, like, Dutch ass power structure, you would not be really welcome in polite society, you know? Mm-hmm.
The best way I think I can compare it to from the Georgia experience is, it sounds like y'all's relationship to him was a lot like our relationship to Truett Cathy down here.
Okay.
Truett Cathy, the founder of Chick-fil-A.
Got it.
Worshipped as a god in Metro Atlanta. Yeah. Like, I can't stress enough.
Or it's like Columbus with fucking what's his name, the limited guy, the guy who was on Epstein's, who like hooked Epstein up with all his good shit.
I forget. Shoot. I'm not sure. I'll have to look it up. Maybe I'll splice it in or something.
We'll stumble across
Les
the name.
Les Wexner.
And... Yeah.
That's not a real name.
No, yeah, I know this guy. I know him not personally, but
thing too, where it's like Wexner went to Ohio State. Ohio State University. There's no other word that needs to be in there, by the way. It's just Ohio State University.
No articles.
And you know, it was his connections and his power that built a lot of the local economy in Columbus, and he continued to sort of give back to the town.
A
very similar dynamic with Rich DeVos, right?
Yes.
And so I remember growing up, the idea of even like attempting to criticize him, his generosity, his like, just, oh, he's just so nice. He's just such an, oh, shucks, great guy. You couldn't fucking do it. Like, it was just, it was that was like profanity, right? Like, just not okay. You can't do that. You can't be nice to our nice grandpa Rich.
In Grand Rapids, the windmills tilt at you. Truly, truly.
Truly.
But yeah, I mean,
Joss,
you know,
carry on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess the larger point here is that's just what generational wealth does, right? Eventually, it ends up at the bottom of the sea. So August 1949, they're back from their fucking boat adventure. They get roped into doing direct sales for Neutralite by a distant relative of Jay's, and they're really good at it. They start the Jari Corporation, with bits of their names, as independent distributors.
Jari?
Jari, yeah.
Amway's a lot catchier than that.
That's not anything. Rich works on his names. In 1957, the founder of Neutralite asks Jay to become the president of the company because they're killing it. He turns it down because they have their sights set on something higher. They start selling new products the following year, and the year after, 1959, they spin off Amway. It's, for me, it's like turning over a rock and there's a whole ecosystem under there. Like, I'm just discovering, you know, the products they sell, like LOC, Satinique, that sort of thing. My grandmother apparently was a distributor at one point. So thank goodness she got out of that.
So what I'm hearing is that you owe like all of your generational wealth to your grandfather and his excellent time as a Amway independent business distributor, right?
All this time, I thought, it's a carpenter and a nurse, you know, the last of the great blue collar success stories. Nope, Amway.
Amway. Okay, great.
It's cool if you found out, like your grandfather was in this book as like an example of compassionate capitalism. It was like, there was this young man I met.
My grandmother was.
Oh, grandmother.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No. Yeah. No, they came by it, honestly. Now, during this time, Rich meets Helen Wessup. He and Jay are in their car. Helen and a friend are walking home from school. Jay knows the friend. Rich offers him a ride home. He's like, yeah, Helen's pretty cute. He asks the friend for Helen's number. They get to talking. Bada bing, bada boom. They get married in 1953.
As these things go.
Their careers continue on. He gives his Selling America speech, Rich does, in the early 1960s. It's an impassioned defense of free enterprise. It stridently opposes socialism. The speech wins an Alexander Hamilton Award for economic education from the Freedoms Foundation.
Alexander Hamilton.
Yo, my name is Rich DeVos. I'm here to defend the free enterprise.
Rich DeVos, a Rolling Stone gathers no moss.
By the time you finish listening to this, you're going to think I'm pretty wise.
Well, but this makes sense when you remember that right after the Second World War, there is a congressional inquiry into Nazi thought, which cited Alexander Hamilton's anti-immigrant, anti-worker views as a strong influence on it. So, you know, there's a little, again, ideological continuity, right. Whole cocktail of this weird shit. He founds the Richard and Helen DeVos Foundation in 1970. It goes on to fund such wonderful organizations as the American Enterprise Institute, the Federalist Society, the Heritage Foundation. He's also a major donor to friends of our show's Focus on the Family.
Yep. Don't forget Acton Institute. That's another one. Mm-hmm, the sort of sicko evangelical / Catholic / libertarian Ayn Rand think tank.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're all wrapped up in libertarianism since like the 50s. He supported Rick Santorum. He supported Newt Gingrich, their campaigns. He was president of, you know, listeners from our Left Behind episode will remember the Council for National Policy, who's president of that briefly.
Yes.
Oh, the Legion of Doom for right-wing ruling class assholes.
Yep.
And as we were discussing earlier, in the early 70s, he chairs the new Grand Rapids Committee, which redevelops the city, results in buildings like the DeVos Performance Hall, the Amway Grand Plaza, which sort of got this whole ball rolling. That's finished in 1981. The opening ceremony is attended by President Gerald Ford, whose museum opens up across the river in the same year. I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent about the museum, but like, if Hitler had won the war, this is the museum that would have been built about him. Like, everything he does casts in the most positive possible light, right?
Yeah, did you find your visit to the Gerald R. Ford Museum to be, Joss? Because I know you checked it out.
Well, it was free. It was free. So, you know, there's that advantage. But I walk in and, you know, it's like walking through a haunted castle, right? Because you'll see the most unexpected shit that is innocuous to those who haven't really done some digging. But if you have, like, early on, it's like, he joined an organization in his college years called America First, you know, anti-war, you know, nothing about how it gets hijacked by reactionary forces.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph McCarthy is mentioned exactly once, and everything else about the socialist camp is like, we're fighting communist totalitarianism. So, you know, no interrogation of McCarthyism, the Red Scare, second Red Scare, really. Of course, the crowning achievement of the museum is rehabilitating his pardon of Nixon. Like, the nation couldn't survive the trial of a former president. Why? Literally, why?
The he talks about it in 10 powerful phrases, and he literally puts it down to like, Christ forgave me, so I forgave Richard Nixon.
It is.
Oh my God! Yeah, I'm sure that's what Gerald Ford was thinking.
Oh, and of course, there's like huge quotes from people like Henry Kissinger attesting to his character. So, you know,
we got it. Yeah, nailed
this,
it.
This Hitler guy is really cool. Satan, you know?
Yeah.
So don't take that out of context. God.
clip. We don't have enough ops for that. It's okay.
During this time in 1971, he breaks ground on the new Amway headquarters, which he calls the Center for Free Enterprise. And yes, again, sir. Groundbreaking ceremony attended by, at the time, Congressman Gerald Ford. The following year, he buys his old friend's Neutralite. The year after, 1973, the Amway headquarters is complete. And he's killing it. He gets into the Direct Selling Hall of Fame in 79. He later presents that same award to his sons. Skipping a little ahead to the 80s, this was wild to me. So after years of openly mocking the LGBT community as it's ravaged by AIDS, Reagan appoints DeVos to his AIDS commission in 1987. Mm-hmm. Now, in a later interview, DeVos would say he was hung in effigy by the gay community since his time serving on the commission. Quote, "I wasn't sympathetic to all their requests for special treatment, because at that time it was always somebody else's fault, and I said, you are responsible for your actions too, you know, conduct yourself properly." You know, and he accused homosexuals of wanting to capture the agenda. He would later go on to donate $100,000 to the anti-gay marriage campaign in Florida. So yeah, really, really stellar guy, really stand-up guy. He's horrible. His health's in trouble by this time. He has bypass surgeries in 1983 and 1992. He's turned down in America for a heart transplant because he's old by this point. He's diabetic. He shops around for a surgeon, talk about special treatments, and he finally finds one in England who agrees to treat him in 97. And as luck would have it, he gets a heart from a woman who has just died in a car crash. By this time, of course, he's started up his literary career. 1975, he writes his first book called Believe, about his
with an exclamation point.
You got to pronounce the exclamation point.
Yeah.
He buys the Orlando Magic in 91. He later gets Orange County, Florida to pick up the tab for their new stadium. He had three hockey teams as well. Two of them folded with the International Hockey League. His son now owns the third. He writes Compassionate Capitalism in 93, was it?
94.
Well, it comes out 94. In 94.
94, cool. Okay. And he retires from Amway that same year, citing health. And his eldest son, Dick, takes over through 02. Dick, of course, married to Betsy DeVos. We mentioned her, championed the right of private schools to discriminate against LGBT students, said it was a school's choice.
And the right of private schools in general. They were big on that. And that's when I realized how influential some of this money had been on my upbringing, going to Christian schools and stuff like that. Not just because when I realized that this book had been quoted or had excerpted in a class I had been, which it was, but also realizing just, a lot of these languages, a lot of these groups that he's funded, you know, Heritage Foundation and whatnot, directly connected. In fact, I went and visited the Heritage Foundation in my ninth grade year when we went on a trip to Washington, D.C.
I can one up you on that one.
Yeah.
I when I was in college, because I went to Calvin College.
Right.
I did the D.C. semester, and we stayed at the Heritage Foundation.
Oh, my God.
They have dorms there on Capitol Hill.
Yeah. I didn't do anything that insane, but I did meet Josh Duggar while I was there. So that's
good.
Pre everything coming out. But yeah, he was there and was very, you know, very proud that everybody knew who he was. He was very arrogant about that.
Sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Josh, I know we keep taking these turns into just insanity, but there's just so much maddening shit that comes out of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and again, you know, it's so, I mean, you know, you want to talk conspiracies, like it's so easy to just completely miss this stuff if you're moving in, you know, the wrong or the right sphere.
What's funny about it is that, like, it's conspiracy to an extent, but it's just out in the open. Like, it's not hidden. That's what makes it.
They're doing an actual conspiracy.
Yeah, they're doing an actual conspiracy and they're putting it in their books. Like, they're just like, yeah, and I did this. I basically bought the town in the 60s. Like, it's just openly saying it, you know, it would be more infuriating. It's like more infuriating than if they were hiding, you know?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And then they have the nerve to act like there's a conspiracy against them.
Well, cause it's interesting the way that this project operates, right? Because you do get the stuff that is just fully out in the open, flagrantly. So, there are the, you know, Rich DeVos sponsoring another $10 million building or whatever and doing some more rich man's graffiti. But then you also do have sort of the stuff like the CNP, right? Where it's hard to even know who's in that, let alone what they do. And so they know very, very well when you should be sort of publicly open and presenting something in a way that is basically selling to people, mm-hmm. which of course is core to what the Amway business model is, and when you should cover up what it is that you're actually doing, because there's a piece of the game that you don't want people to know about.
He does kind of give the game away toward the end of Compassionate Capitalism, because he casually drops, oh yeah, and by the way, you know, Jay Van Andel was on the board of directors of the National Endowment for Democracy.
Right.
Uh-huh. Oh boy.
I mean, so, yes. You can feel his. I'm not feel it. Like he's got those moments. Yeah, throughout it, where you can feel him just itching to be like, by the way, free enterprise, but we need to take down these countries.
They
like, you can feel with Cuba. You can feel his trigger finger itching.
Mm-hmm.
He needs revenge for the boat.
Yes, it was there. The communists somehow did it years right. before they took power. Like Ted mm-hmm. Cruz's father having to flee, and
Fidel Castro personally fired a depth charge at their ship.
God, that'd be so cool.
Epic red battles of history. Granma versus Elizabeth II.
Jesus.
So, yes, he writes 10 powerful phrases in his golden years in 2008.
Second
to
last book, right? Because he's got that awful autobiography.
Simply Rich in 2014, yeah.
It's and, great title.
Yes.
Yeah. Have to hand
it's so smug, my goodness. But, I mean, God. You got to respect the audacity.
Yeah.
In a sense. So Helen dies in 2017 at the age of 90. Rich dies the following year at 92. This was weird to me. He spent the last 10 years of his life sinking money into mending the schism between his Christian Reformed Church in North America and the Reformed Church in America, which it split off from, because his grandparents had been on either side of it. It's just weird, like, hobbyist political shit you can get up to when you have more money.
Yeah, what's the deal with that? Do you know anything about that, Josh?
Oh, do I know anything about that?
What's the deal with that?
So basically, the deal is that when the Dutch Protestants came over originally from, you know, Podunk middle of nowhere, and settled in Podunk middle of nowhere in Michigan, they established a church, right? Mm-hmm. And they called it the Dutch Reformed Church, right? Mm-hmm. And they, of course, were reclaiming the name Dutch Reformed Church from the actual Dutch Reformed Church in the Netherlands, because they were doing it right.
Yeah, it was the good reform.
Correct. But there ended up being some conflicts within the denomination, and in a fit of pique, a few people in the denomination went and formed something called the True Dutch Reformed Church, which I
love. Uh-huh.
That's cool.
I love it. And so this then ended up developing into the CRCNA, the Christian Reformed Church of North America, the RCA, the Reformed Church of America. Betsy DeVos is herself pretty well connected to the RCA. She donates, or at least she has in the past. I don't know if she does anymore, but historically has contributed quite a bit of money to churches in the denomination. The CRC, on the other hand, is the denomination I grew up with. RCA is like maybe nominally a little bit more progressive, but there's not really any real difference between them. Calvin College is the school of the CRC. Hope College is the school of the RCA. They were sort of crosstown rivals, you know, 30 minutes drive apart from each other.
So why did he fail? He seems to have failed in his reunification effort.
Because I remember, like, there had been for a while real talk of reunification, and I think it actually might be to do with culture war wedge issues, specifically around gay marriage.
Uh-huh.
Because that's been a big wedge issue for the CRCNA as of late, to the extent that, like, there's probably actually going to be another denominational split coming up pretty soon, because the CRCNA recently forced a decision to make it so that, like, gay sex is a sin is now a confessional issue. So, like, that means that basically you can't, you know, ordained minister, you can't officiate same-sex marriages. You can't have a gay person serving as a clergy member, really, in any capacity. And so the culture war is going to bring us all down, thanks to the woke mind virus. And
continued
that's
splintering.
Yeah,
I appreciate I appreciate that context, because it shows, while it's like not necessarily part of this book, it shows like what these people obsess over and what they really feel deeply, because there are a lot of things in this where I'm like, okay, you're just saying that. And there are things that he does feel very deeply and obsessively.
Yeah. There are a few things where it's like he is clearly like saying something again for the sake of the pitch.
Yeah.
But there is very, very little in here that he does not truly.
He's authentic in the way that he can be authentic.
Right.
In the way that like whatever is left of him can be authentic.
Right.
So Joss, I guess he just died because he was 92 and on his second heart. Is that the no cool story behind that?
Oh yeah, yeah. He was very, very old, diabetic, had heart problems his whole senior life. But I mean, you know, he lived into his 90s, you know, and he died incredibly wealthy. Amway last year, I believe, pulled down like $8.9 billion.
Yeah. No, they do real numbers, and I know they have some partner organizations, and I'm sure there's all kinds of more money than we can imagine in there. But no, that's a good summary of this fascinating guy. But the thing is, you might think that with all that description that he is a cold hearted, ruthless business tyrant. But no, he's actually really compassionate.
He's really nice.
He's a good guy.
he wrote
Compassionate Capitalism, which there are these two books that we're talking about. And we said it before we started recording, but 10 Powerful Phrases is the second one. And 10 Powerful Phrases is the later one that is more. It feels like an addendum. It feels like, hey, here's some like extra stuff. It feels like DLC for the original book. There's a lot of things that it's quoting. Again, it doesn't really feel like a complete piece of work. Like I read it so fast. I read both these quickly, but I read it so fast. Like it was unbelievable. I don't have a lot to say I'm kind of talking about them together, but I wanted to. Well, I'm not going to read all the credos, but
there's 24 of them. So
in Compassionate Capitalism, every chapter starts with a credo. And I just want to give you an example of what these kind of credos are. So just as a quote, here's the first
credo. He puts them all at the end in case you missed them.
Yes. Right. No, he gives them a list. Mm-hmm. Credo one, we believe that every man, woman, and child is created in God's image. And because of that, each has worth, dignity, and unique potential. Therefore, we can dream great dreams for ourselves and others. Skipping forward, credo four, we believe that getting our finances in order, paying off our debts, learning to share with others, setting financial limits, and faithfully living within them is the beginning of getting our lives free to move forward. Therefore, we need to get our bills paid and our financial priorities in order. It's that kind of thing. You know, we believe that owning our business to supplement or replace our current income is the best way to guarantee our personal freedom and our family's financial future, that kind of thing. And he loves the own your own business thing. And to be clear with Amway, the concept is you can be a distributor. It's the multi-level marketing thing. You own your own business. You are under other people, but you own it, quote unquote. So he is talking about how he's made thousands of businesses for people. That is kind of what he means. He is profiting off of it. But he also has, and it's fascinating because, Joss, you made the point that he had all these failed business ventures. The thing is, him as a guy, he wants to own the owning the business is the interesting thing to him, not really what the business does.
Yeah.
Because he started with this flight business. And while he had that history in the Air Force, he said he didn't know how to fly a plane. It was a flight school. Then he went into restaurant stuff, and then he went into boats, and then he went into direct sales, and he just went with products that he could sell. His fascination is with ownership. And this book is very much about entrepreneurship. And it is about, hey, you could work your whole life and slave away, or you could own. And he does, you know, put in some qualifiers like, hey, you could be a compassionate capitalist and work a job, but wouldn't it be awesome if you could own your own business? And wouldn't you know it, 95% of it in here, owning a business means working for Rich DeVos.
Right.
And what's funny is, you know, the whole thing that, rideshare, that like gig economy industries are going through right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where people are classified as independent contractors and thus like not eligible for benefits that like actual workers would be. That started in the 30s with these direct sales businesses.
Mm-hmm. And Amway really brought it international. I also want to note before we like really get into the text, because this is really cool. This is my first just dropping in. The book's divided into four parts, and it's get ready, get set, go, and reaching our goals. I was like, come on. What? Like, I immediately was like, what the hell is this?
Well,
you broke your format.
Yes. And the weird thing, too, about the, like, reaching our goals is that then he brings in like another list of like other things that are also mantras, but like a subset of mantras. It's so weird. This guy, it's this strange combination of manifesto and self-help book, and it's not really sure which side of the fence it wants to fall down on.
Well, it falls down on both sides of the fence of East and West Germany. I'll tell you that. Because he is very, this book, you know, for historical context, like we were saying, 1994, the Soviet Union has fallen just a few years before. It seems like the concept of socialism is, I mean, dead to him, though then he'll, of course, come on to be terrified of it coming back. So is it dead? I'm not sure. He can't seem to decide. He seems to think we're, quote, going socialist in 2008. So, you know, make of that what you will. But he, and in this book, he's talking, you know, very much like the Soviet Union has fallen. China has free economic zones now. Cuba is going to fall any day now. Didn't end up happening, but, you know, he seemed to think it was the case.
His wording here is capitalism has become the world's economic system of choice, which is hilarious to me. You know, when you consider that, you know, what the dissolution of the Soviet Union, right? Illegal, undemocratic. Most people voted against it, right? It's
no, they chose. Come on. They chose.
And it's one of those things where it's like, it also just feels weird, whatever your, you know, beliefs are, even if you are, you know, a compassionate capitalist, quote unquote, he's doing a whole lot of like end zone dancing here. Which is notable because he also has these, we need to be compassionate in the people in these countries that have fallen apart and the life expectancy has fallen by years. But also like he said, as soon as the wall was down, thousands of Amway people poured across into Eastern Germany to try and sell his cheap bullshit. It's unbelievable.
Right. Yeah.
It is,
I mean,
so dark.
It was such a like gold rush opportunity in the whole Eastern
Bloc. Oh yeah.
And he talks about it a fair bit, but I mean, look, if you want to know why socialism failed, he tells us right here.
No, he does.
I got a quote. Marx's socialism failed for many reasons, but at the heart of that economic system's collapse was this. People were not motivated to get the job done. They couldn't own their piece of the world's natural resources. They couldn't even own the tools with which they worked. As a result, they didn't even own their own human energy. Like natural resources and tools, the worker was owned by the state.
And like, look, we're not a history podcast. We're not going to go into all the reasons every socialist nation has failed or succeeded. Very rarely is it because people were lazy.
Nobody wants to work anymore.
Yeah, it's funny because it's just an oft-repeated thing. What's the motivation to work? And it's like, that's just, that was never the problem in any of these countries, is people weren't working. Which is like, I know it's cynical on its face, but it's just a very bizarre criticism that you hear. And he's like going back and forth because then later on, he's like, no one worked because they didn't have an incentive to. But then he's like, it was authoritarian and they were like under the whip. And it's like, well, were they not working?
Which one is it? Yeah.
No, you know what? You know what? The whip crackers also didn't want to work. There we go.
That's true.
Nobody wants to crack whips anymore. Yeah.
That's true. That's the problem. Except Rich. He does. But it's a nice whip.
Yes.
So yeah, the setup of the book, I mean, he's going through and it's a baffling. It's kind of baffling and it's kind of unstructured in the way he moves through it. Like I said, his structure is get ready, get set, go, and reach our goals. So like it's off the bat and it's just these credos that come down. It's very self-repeating and it's basically the idea is capitalism, free enterprise is good. That's his concept.
Right.
The government needs to assure life, liberty, pursuit of happiness and get out of the way. And what he means by that is not compassionate capitalism in some sort of Nordic model and like, oh, a baseline of welfare. He means like compassionate capitalism as individual capitalists, individual actors should be good people.
Yes.
Yes.
It doesn't go that far in defining what good people are, aside from maybe you should give stuff away sometime. And
they're compassionate.
They're compassionate, broadly understood. He says you don't have to be a Christian, but then he spends a whole lot of time talking about being a Christian.
What's interesting is that like every time he talks about being a Christian, he's also like, or you could be Jewish.
Yes.
Like, I don't know why. Like he talks about churches and he's like, yeah, there are churches and synagogues. There's the talk about like the Judeo-Christian mentality. And so much of this is, I think, this thing that is very common among a certain type of Christian, which is basically just to treat Judaism as like Rev A Christianity, right? Where like Christianity was basically the patch, but we will still like it's still compatible, right? With the original version, which is Judaism. It doesn't treat them as two different schools of thought or philosophical traditions or intellectual traditions or anything. It just fucking flattens it.
And he says you can believe in other things, but like his one mention of Islam is basically to just be like, this guy was into Islam and then he realized that he should be a Christian. So like, you know, make of his claims to that what you will. Now, it is true that I'm sure he's willing to have anybody in his industry that can be profitable as a distributor. But
he really likes talking about his black friends.
He does. He does like to say, this was my African-American friend. You can hear him kind of highlight it. Yeah.
He fucking recruited half of the fucking Baltimore Colts into into his fucking thing. There are so many mentions of former players for the Baltimore Colts.
Oh, yeah. And there's just a lot of what I was going to say. There's just half of this is just anecdotes, just stories. And I will say, to give him his fair shake, he's pretty decent at like telling a story pretty quickly and efficiently and getting his message across.
He's competent.
Yeah. X person did X and X happened. Mm-hmm. He's pretty good at that. He's good at making you like, oh, I feel bad for this family that went through this hard time. Yeah. Now, some of the stories are part and parcel of,
you know, being really, really good at direct sales, right? You know, he's a good
communicator. Yeah. He's a salesman. He is a good, I don't think he's a bad communicator. I think he's lost some of his sauce by 10 powerful phrases. I think Compassionate Capitalism is a much more effectively written book. That is not to say that I don't think this book needs an editor. I think this book could be half as long as it is easily. And like, there'll be moments where I'm like, I like found myself skimming and I was like, I don't need to skim. And then I read it and then I was like, oh, I really could have skimmed.
Yeah. If you've got that thought in the back of your mind that you could skim it, you're absolutely right. And I think to the point of like how baffling some of these stories are, I do have one example here.
Yes, please.
Where like, this is presented as being like, wow, isn't this a relatable like situation?
Is it where the woman tried to kill her husband?
Yes.
Oh God!
Sorry. Go ahead.
No. So we're introduced to a couple, a family called the Foglios, or maybe it's Foglio. Guy. I don't know. Probably some Italians. F O G L I O.
Foglio. Yeah.
Foglio. It's a me, Foglio, and
my husband.
So it's Norma and Joe Foglio. And we learn that like Joe basically had a job that involved somehow outsourcing certain labor to Mexico.
It was high rises. He was in the high rise construction.
He was in the construction business, which, you know, Italians. But then what ends up happening is that according to Norma, then Mexico devalued her currency, Norma remembers. Our net worth plummeted. We were sure that the president of Mexico was out to destroy us. Actually, it was rather nice to have someone new to blame. I even tried to shoot Joe once, Norma admits sheepishly. Thank God I never could hit the broadside of a barn with a shotgun. The pellets hit the car and broke the wet bedroom window, but missed Joe completely. If I'd had better aim, I might have killed him. Then, after a long thoughtful pause, she adds, and just think of all the good years we would have missed together if I had killed him during the bad. This is deranged.
Oh my God.
I mean, you know, Victor Hugo writes in Les Miserables that souls left in darkness will commit sin, and the guilty one is not he who commits the sin, it's he who casts the shadow. But who casts the shadow, according to Rich DeVos? It's the government with its taxes and regulations.
Right. And it might be the American... Well, Mexican, it could be the American government or the Mexican government, but you're right. It's the fault of the governing bodies. And this story wraps up. Oh, by the way, one thing that's amazing is that he throws in a statistic about physical abuse and the dollar amount that personal injury causes to the United States economy. But then,
the couple has a son die too.
Right.
The couple also has a kid die.
Joe gets arrested in Mexico.
Yeah.
And
no, this is a much more interesting story than it. Like this would make a great like limited series, but not inspiring.
But what I love is the way that he wraps this up, right? This is what Rich says to wrap up this insane story of like trauma and loss and almost shooting your husband to death and then getting arrested in Mexico. Somehow Norma found the necessary funds to secure her husband's release. It was a painful and terrifying time for them both. But now, looking back, the Foglios see the dangerous, embarrassing episode as a perfect example of the crazy, irresponsible things people are prone to do when they are feeling desperate and depressed. Whomst among us hasn't, right?
Like, yeah. And Joe and Nora, they go on and, you know, Amway is the way.
Right.
You know, when man says there is no way, God says, look, Amway. I wrote down Joe and Nora. I feel that it sucks, but I can't stress enough. The solution is to sell bullshit. Like, his solution is sell my cheap bullshit products that you could get in any fucking store and that there is no contribution. His solution isn't like, I don't know, go and find something meaningful to do with your life. He wants to make this, and like, don't get me wrong, you can be a salesman, I don't care, but like, he wants to portray just doing this as being worthwhile, and he never has a reason why the sales are worthwhile. He never says, here's why it's rewarding to make a sale. He very rarely talks about sales. I would have liked to hear that. Why does making sales make you feel good? Why do you enjoy like doing something? But it's not that. It's just owning it.
And to him, there's nothing that gives your life meaning other than your work, right? I mean, in the very next section, right, he has the story about a woman who reaches her mandatory retirement age working for a bank, right?
That was so dark.
She
reaches. Wait, Joss, finish the story so the listeners know. Because I interrupt you. That's my bad.
So I mean, belying the darkness of it is, it's written in my notes as old granny, mind broken by her job, never took a single day off. Which is true. She never took a day off for personal reasons, for health reasons, like for herself at all. And after she reaches the mandatory retirement, here it is. The very next morning, just one day after her retirement party, the woman appeared at the bank and stood looking in the window. Finally, she came in, walked up to her old desk, stood over the young woman who'd replaced her, trying to tell her how to do the job she had been doing all those years. I found out later that the older woman had never taken a vacation or even a day off for sickness and personal business. Her whole life was that bank, and when her job ended, her life ended. Day after day, she came back to her old desk and stood there looking more and more helpless, more and more desperate. Finally, the manager told the bank guard to escort that poor woman from the building. We never saw her again. I've often wondered how long it took after the death of her dreams before she, too, ended up in the grave.
So that's where he wraps that up. But then doesn't he keep going? And he talks about, well, if only she'd been able to, like, be an Amway distributor, she could have found meaning in her life.
Literally, yeah. No, it's he returns to their eldest. The Foglios, their eldest child Nikki, dies in a motorcycle accident.
R.I.P.
Struggles with alcohol and drug abuse. You know, and he's like, well, you know, we must not give in to grief or let our failures and disappointments turn us into victims.
No, I wrote down, no, don't kill yourself. You're so profitable. Aha! Like it is that, like,
literally.
He has a whole bit about depression, and he's like, look, sometimes we need pills. But and I like that he literally just says the solution is hope, not dope. Like thanks, I guess, man. Like,
but just also, like, I think it would bear very briefly then describing sort of what the Amway business model actually looks like. Like, what does being an independent distributor of Amway entail? Right. That basically, when you are one of these distributors, you first have to have somebody who is above you in the pyramid, because again, this is just a pyramid scheme. And the people who are above you in your upline are entitled to a cut of the profits that you make in the sales of your business. So this, of course, means that those people who were able to get in on sort of the gold rush in the late 50s and early 60s would really be the only ones who could make a true living off of this, because they get to enjoy the benefits of a substantial downline, right?
You notice, like, everyone in this book is like, they went on to found the biggest or almost the biggest in the country. And it's like, yeah, you're talking about like the first 20 guys.
Exactly. And looking, I was curious, so I went and I looked at Amway's mandatory income disclosure, which they've posted on their website, and this is from 2022. And if we look at their earnings, the earnings that they have here are marked based on pre-expense revenue. So this does not count buying the shit, right? This is strictly, this is not profit, this is revenue. the top 1%, right? So one out of every 100 people is pulling down an average, a mean of $87,422, which is decent money, but that's not amazing money.
No,
and the median is $56,096. That's the top 1%. We drill down to the top 10%. The mean is 14,552. The median is 4,610.
And then when Jesus.
And then when we get down to the 50th percentile, right? One half. The average, the mean is $3,452 annually. The median is $679. So there is
those guys aren't positive though, is there?
No.
They don't have positivity.
They're not positive in any sense. They don't have enough positivity, and they're also not earnings positive.
Yeah, they're just in the red. Yeah,
And what's insane to me is that I can't remember. I think it was in Amway as neoliberal religious tradition. By many accounts, there are your upline makes most of their money not from selling products, but from selling what DeVos calls tools, right? You know, correspondence choruses, tickets to rallies, right? Nice. As much as like 95% in one instance of
there's a tie-in video series to this book. That's huge. I mean, that's huge in everything in capitalism. But in right-wing spaces, they love the extra stuff. It's very common in like church, evangelical media. I know we've talked about it with Left Behind, how much just tacked on bullshit there was. And this is that same type of thing. It is probably the same companies making the videos. It is just a bunch of tacked on stuff, tickets. It's just like just extra stuff. And I don't know quite how to like – I kept trying to figure out how to like articulate this. Is like – he never at any point is like, this is what we do and this is why it matters beyond just like people and money. And it's not, and it can sound very nice at times. And it can sound convincing at times, especially, you know, if you're in the right, like kind of person he's preaching to, but you don't get like to kind of call back to earlier, the very opening of the episode. I was on a picket line earlier today. And I asked someone, you've worked here for 30 years. They've been working for a Stellantis plant. Why do you like it? And he says, because when I look at the cars on the road, I know we worked hard and we made those cars and I check every brake line several times and I know it works and I know those cars run and I know people are going to drive them and they're going to go to their jobs. And he material something. This guy's, by the way, not getting paid shit, getting mistreated at his job. That's why he's striking. But he feels a attachment to what he's doing because there is something to it. There is something material is contributing something. This book tells endless stories of people who were pulled out of professions, doing things, being a pilot, being a technician.
There's
being
the guy,
a teacher.
One of the guys he talks about is a fucking flight controller who got fired by Ronald Reagan.
Oh my God. I just texted Joss like all caps. I was like, why was he fired? Why was
the story that's most deranged to me is there's a couple of people who become distributors, right? And they're tired or whatever. I think from a long day of distributing, and they hand the wheel.
All this distributing is tiring me out.
They hand the wheel of their car over to their 16-year-old. The 16-year-old, of course, is not an experienced driver. Makes a mistake, ends up crashing the car, killing both of the parents. And the psychologist who helps the kids through this horrific traumatic event hears about their history as distributors and becomes a distributor. That's a virus. It's a fucking
grim.
Virus.
That's grim.
He has some really like he has the really dark one of the kid who was like a farm laborer as a child. He's got that one who was like a laborer who like ends up becoming an Amway distributor. And he's like, instead of resenting the guy who owned it and his children who were playing by the pool all day, I learned to be an Amway distributor.
Oh, yeah.
He's got the guy who's a former he was like involved in like, I don't know if he was like a Black Panther, but he was involved in like the Black Liberation Movement who went to prison.
He was a former Nation of Islam guy.
Yeah, Nation of Islam guy. And he was like, I learned the love of Jesus and to distribute Amway products. He's got a guy who said, I never stood up for the national anthem because I was always because like I was told I couldn't get ahead as a black guy.
That was one of my favorites.
I learned that Amway doesn't see color, and then I stood proudly and sang the national anthem with tears in my eyes.
And everybody clapped.
Yeah, everybody clapped.
I've got one. I found the thing that you were talking about, Justin. I just want to read it out.
Yes.
Jim, first of all, I need to say, some of the names of these people, I cannot believe that these are real names. This guy's name is Jim Floor. J-I-M-F-L-O-O-R. But I prefer to think that it's like the floor of a gymnasium. Jim Floor told us a moving story to prove this point. The point being that like hope in Jesus in the Bible or something.
Yeah.
2 years ago, a couple with their own successful distribution business was driving home to Sacramento from a function in Los Angeles. The father was tired and asked his 16-year-old daughter to drive while he took a nap. Confused by her father's sudden directions, the young girl tried to make a quick turn. The car rolled over. Both parents were killed. The 16-year-old and her 12-year-old brother survived, but both were left with emotional scars from the accident and a terrible sense of loss. But those children lived in the people helping people atmosphere I described, Jim tells us. Immediately, they were literally adopted into the homes of their parents' upline mentors, who had no children of their own. From the moment their natural parents died, those two children had new parents to love, cherish, and mentor them. Which, okay, if this indeed happened as described and they were able to have a loving family where there otherwise wouldn't have been one, great. But this is not an example of why Amway is a good thing. Like you can't be like, oh yeah, the natural multi-level structure provided by this great company and us being empowered, compassionate capitalists allowed this to happen. No, this is just people
community.
Stepping up. This is community, and you can find this anywhere.
Well, because I mean, he gives the game away in fucking Simply Rich. Dave Ramondam writes in Compassionate Capitalism, Amway, and the Role of Small Business Conservatives in the New Right. He alludes to it. He says Richard DeVos wrote, "When we started Amway, we thought it's okay to start a business to make money, but what's the ultimate purpose of our business? What does it stand for? What's driving it emotionally beyond just trying to make money? So standing up for free enterprise was our battle cry." It's not the money; it's the ability to extract money from the fucking like chumps who are slaving away for you. I mean, DeVos himself says it. You know, you can either work a drudgery like toilish job, or you can take a chance. You can become somebody who breaks that cycle. You know, he acknowledges that there have to be chumps doing the fucking scut work and being paid scut wages.